liebe gern. Well, ladies and gentlemen, dear members and friends of the Schiller Institute, I think we all assemble here today in the full knowledge about the extremely grave situation mankind finds itself. And at this point, it is not clear if this mankind will have a future or not. So the reason why I'm saying this is because we have the coincidence of several existential crises which each would be sufficient to pose a question about the survivability of the human species. Now, first, the most dangerous and immediate one is naturally the possibility that the crisis in the Middle East and now spreading quickly to Northern Africa has become a new Balkans, what the Balkans was before World War I, which is like an alliance, a combination of alliances, which once you have a trigger, one more step beyond what it is now could ignite World War III. And this time it would be a thermonuclear war, because as everybody knows, for example, a strike against Iran would absolutely immediately trigger a thermonuclear Third World War. It could even be a situation starting with the toppling of the Assad government or just continuous chaos as we see it right now with the spread of Al-Qaeda in the Middle East and Northern Africa. Now, if it would come to this thermonuclear war, it is a very good likelihood that nobody would be left, that you would have a thermonuclear nuclear winter in which, you know, the people who die in the first hours would praise themselves or could praise themselves to be the happy ones as compared to those who die later. The problem is that this is no longer in the minds of people, but remember that President Kennedy during the Cuban Missile Crisis said exactly that. And now with the arrival of much larger weapon arsenals, the power of extinction has absolutely increased. Now the second major existential, potentially existential crisis is the fact that the entire transatlantic financial system, as a result of the high-risk speculation, the 25% profit, as Mr. Ackermann liked to say, and the continuous bailout policies of the too-big-to-fail banks has now come to a situation where the only thing left is a hyperinflationary blowout of the entire system. Now, if that happens, and we are, you know, seeing signs that it could happen this week or the coming week or in February or anyway these weeks, then you would have a hyperinflation like in Germany in 1923, and that means the most brutal expropriation of the population at large. Now, if this would happen, you would have a political and social crisis beyond belief, because if you think that the entire Eurozone, the dollar zone, and then spreading to the rest of the world would have a hyperinflation like it happened in Germany in 1923, the chaos would plunge civilization immediately in a dark age. Now, the third crisis I want to mention is the unbelievable cultural and moral crisis. If you think about the spread of drugs, pornography, violence, and especially how that has affected the youth culture, where you not only have more and more massacres like that in Newtown, wild people shooting many other of their children and teachers, but you have a crisis in the heads of the young people. If you have 12-year-old children who know it all, who you know, have done everything possible, you know, in terms of pornography, rape, and so forth, what is left of the mind of this generation? And that is something which also affects the United States and all of Europe, and unfortunately, many other countries with globalization. Now, the image of man, which is the underlying axiom of all of these crises, has turned into a bestial image where the values have become completely depraved and degenerated. And this is not because man is like that. I don't believe that man is innate evil. I just think that the oligarchical system, which is driving this globalization, has done exactly what the Roman Empire did to lower the morality of the people consciously, to dumb them down so that they are pretty defenseless, or so it seems, because if you go in the streets, as we do it every day, people say, oh, there is nothing you can do, and that is the sure sign of an oligarchy when people are saying that. So the point I'm making is the crisis is so multifaceted that only a complete paradigm shift, a complete change of values is going to solve this problem. Almost 46 years ago, on the 4th of April 1967, Martin Luther King spoke in this very church with a speech with the title "Beyond Vietnam, a Time to Break the Silence," which was a very, very emotional and powerful attack on the Vietnam War. And he said, "We are in deep need of a new way beyond darkness that seems to so close around us." And then he called for a radical revolution of values. Now, the existential requirement of today is exactly that. We need a total fundamental shift in the paradigm, and it must be an upshift as fundamental as the paradigm shift which separated the Middle Age from modern times, what Nicolaus of Cusa, with his writings, consciously evoked when he consciously broke with the dominating ideology of the time, which was scholasticism, which was superstition beyond belief, which was the logical thinking of the peripatetics of his time. And he introduced basically a completely different way of thinking, which led to all the breakthroughs of the modern age, the breakthroughs in modern science, the breakthroughs in classical composition, and many other things. Now, what I find the most horrifying in thinking about this present situation is that how close we are to a complete catastrophe, and that all the governments, at least the leading governments, the G20 and many other governments, don't even want to acknowledge that. And they keep doing things, you know, which lead step by step further on the road to catastrophe. Now, the German government yesterday was reported to also now produce fighting drones. Now, you know, this is insane. Why would you continue a policy which is, you know, murdering people, where you have absolutely no way to differentiate between criminals, terrorists, and civilian casualties? And the problem is not only the governments are not responding, but they are on a course which is leading to disaster. But the population is depraved too. I think I agree on that point with my next speaker, that, you know, it's only, unfortunately, a very small portion of people who have the morality and the guts to, you know, do something. And the purpose of this conference and previous and following conferences is to appeal to those maybe 5% of the population who have the courage to go against the mainstream and to go against this present paradigm. People who must be guided by an inner truth, who are capable of thinking through the consequences of the present policies. Because the vast majority, probably 95% or more, are other-directed. They like depraved entertainment. They are seeking pleasure in the here and now. Or they are so preoccupied with the burden of getting their daily meals and survival, that they don't have the energy to think through the larger issues of strategy, history, science, and culture. Now, therefore, we have to find and mobilize those 5% who have the intellectual and moral disposition to come together and affect this paradigm shift. We had a conference end of last year near Frankfurt, and we will have many more such conferences and invite people to contribute papers, discussions, seminars to define the new paradigm. Because this is the absolute necessary flanking environment which has to occur. We have to mobilize the better parts of the population, but if push comes to shove, we are so short-term in the crisis that unless the American Congress implements immediately in the next days Glass-Steagall, and if that happens, similar things will fall into motion in Europe, chaos will erupt in the short term. I can assure you that, you know, if you talk to some of the top bankers, when they are honest and private, they admit that this thing could come down in 1 minute, and, you know, that the people who are pushing these policies are completely irresponsible. Now, Glass-Steagall is the absolutely necessary first step. And it does not look so bad because we have led an unbelievably successful mobilization to bring Glass-Steagall on the table internationally. The separation of the banks, Trennbanken system, as it's called in German, was completely unknown 2 years ago. And reading my morning mail this morning, I saw an article in Süddeutsche Zeitung that the bankers are now coming around to see that politics is getting serious with separation of the banks, that it's no longer just the crazy people, the Spinner, meaning us, obviously, who are pushing that, but that while it is not yet decided if you will have Vickers Commission, Volker Ruhl, Frank Dodd, Liikanen proposal, all these watered-down versions, or whatever, they naturally don't mention Glass-Steagall, they don't mention the law of capture in the Congress, that coming in light of the fact that the German election campaign is going into high gear for the federal election, this will be the dominating subject. And I can promise you, we will make sure it will be the real Glass-Steagall. Now, also in the United States, Richard Fisher gave a very important address in the National Press Club about a week ago, where he called for the separation of the too big to fail banks. And, why is it necessary to have that? Now, last week there was a panel discussion in Königstein in Taunus near Frankfurt with the participants of Anju Jain, now co-director of Deutsche Bank, Jamie Dimon of J.P. Morgan, Klaus Engel, the CEO of the chemical firm Evonik, Nikolaus von Bomhardt, the CEO of Munich Re, the largest reinsurance company of the world. And in this debate, where the banks was the subject, Klaus Engel said, the head of the chemical bank, he said, well, at least our toxic products are highly regulated. And then Jamie Dimon responded, well, your mistakes have cost life, ours not. Well, I cannot let that stand because this is a case of chutzpah as I have not ever seen it, and especially coming from J.P. Morgan, because immediately after Franklin D. Roosevelt's death, it was the very J.P. Morgan Bank which started to undo the strict regulation of Glass-Steagall, which had first fruits in the 50s. In 1984, it was J.P. Morgan where Alan Greenspan, who was a director in that bank at that time, produced a pamphlet, How to Undo Glass-Steagall. When Alan Greenspan was head of the Fed, in the 80s and the 90s, he step by step undermined Glass-Steagall. And naturally, in 99 there was the repeal of Glass-Steagall and all the deregulation started, he was absolutely in the picture. Now, this deregulation led to the IT bubble, then the secondary mortgage bubble, and then in 2007, the present global financial crisis erupted full steel. And the policy of bailout package after bailout package occurred. In the United States, nobody knows exactly because the Federal Reserve refuses audits, they don't have transparencies, but maybe $30 trillion alone for the US banks. In the same way, there has been, in the same time, there has been a complete transformation of private gambling debt into state debt, which has erupted in the so-called state debt crisis, which in reality is a banking crisis and a gambler crisis. Now they turn around and say, we want to have cuts, balanced budget at the expense of the living standard of the population. Now the opposition party in Greece, the independent party, on the 16th of January launched a file against the so-called Troika, the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the European Union Commission, for crimes against humanity at the International Criminal Court of Justice for the measures which that Troika has imposed between May 2010 and today. And they say that this policy has led to 3,500 suicides, 1.5 million job losses, thousands of firms closing down. And this is a violation of Article 2 of the Rome Statutes and the Charter of Fundamental Rights of the EU that was concluded in Nice in December 2000, and which says everyone has the right to life. Now, the state, according to the suit, has the obligation to take the necessary measures to protect the life of every individual. Now, this is just Greece. In Italy, there are now marches of widows of entrepreneurs who have committed suicide as the result of these policies. The former UN Rapporteur for Food of the United Nations, Jean Ciclar, said that every 5 minutes, as a result of these policies, a child dies. 23 people die of hunger every day. A car fueled by biofuel could feed 1 SUV tank fueled by biofuel needs 352 kilograms of mice, which a child could live on for one full year. Now, as a result of these policies, 2.2 million children in the European Union are undernourished. 43 million people in the United States depend on food stamps. In Spain, 55% of the teachers bring food in the school because that's the only food the children get. Now, Jean Ciclar says, in light of the fact that we have all the technologies to solve that, and the planet could feed easily 12 billion people, he calls this murder. And he describes very, very dramatically how hunger is the worst way of death. It leads to a terrible agony. People become lethargical. Then it leads to a collapse of the immune system. You get bloody dysentery. You have extreme pain. Then the last stage is an atrophy of muscles and then death. And I think we should think about that because banking policies are not unrelated to the consequences, no matter what people tell you. We have in all of Europe, especially naturally Great Britain and the United States, a three-class medicine. Rich people can afford good Medicare. Then there are some people who are taken care for, but many cannot afford to go to the doctor because they cannot even pay the prescribed medicine. So this is cutting people's life short. Now, 5.5 years after the outbreak of the crisis in July 2007, there is more toxic rot in the banks than ever. We were told this by top bankers in Europe who agree with our Glass-Steagall approach. Already in 2003, Warren Buffett called derivatives weapons of mass destruction. And these weapons of mass destruction have been threatened every time a bailout package was due to happen. For example, when Mr. Dallara of the IFF, the International Financial Institute, which is the lobby of the 620 largest banks, is sitting at the EU summit tables, they always threaten, you know, if you don't do what we tell you, the whole banking system will disintegrate. And this same Mr. Dallara in Davos at the present World Economic Forum just said a new big storm is about to occur. Now, and then he blamed the G20 of not having done enough. So in the meantime, if you look at what have these universal banks too big to fail accomplished, Libor scandal, the 14 largest banks have defrauded their customers over several decades for several hundred billions of dollars. The Hongsheng Banking Corporation has been accused, but unfortunately not punished, for laundering of 85% of the Mexican drug money, money which, according to Costa, the previous UN rapporteur for drugs, and Viktor Ivanov, the Russian counterpart, is the only reason why the financial system has not yet collapsed, and which is done by every single bank of any size. Deutsche Bank was caught in CO2 certificate trading, tax evasion, and in December there were two raids against the offices of Deutsche Bank. In one case, 500 armed police. Now, that's not a small contingent. Lenny Breuer, the head of the Justice Criminal Division, was just exposed in a TV program called Frontline, he was asked, why is it that not one Wall Street banker was prosecuted for these crimes? And then Breuer gave the answer that he is sleepless during the night because what would happen if you go after Bank A, it would have a ripple effect on all the others. And then Senator Ted Kaufman said, it's very disturbing because it's not the job of a prosecutor to lie awake in the night and worry, but to prosecute criminal behavior. Now, Richard Fischer called for the cutting into pieces the two big banks to fail. 0.2% of the banks in the United States control 69% of the assets. And Fischer also correctly noted that Dodd-Frank, which includes the full Volcker Rule, made things worse. So therefore, we need the full Glass-Steagall, as Roosevelt did it, and Volcker also made the point that if you try to regulate a totally untransparent system of derivatives and creative financial instruments with an even more complex system of regulation, it cannot work. Now, just look at what they have accomplished. The draft of Basel III, which was supposed to increase the capital ownings of the banks, has 616 pages. The quarterly report to the Fed spreadsheet has 2,271 columns. The 2010 Dodd-Frank bill has 848 pages. And so many rules that it could amount to 30,000 pages of legal addendums if fully codified. Now, do you really think that this impresses anybody? And that is obviously the tactic they always use, that nobody can really understand it. And the only way to solve this is Glass-Steagall. Separate the banks and basically, you know, protect the commercial banks, tell the investment banks to solve their problem on their own without taxpayer money, and if they have to declare insolvency, so be it. Then, naturally, we need an immediate credit system. If you don't do that, we will have, in the next days or weeks, uncontrollable chaos, a hyperinflationary blowout. And this is now already acknowledged. For example, Professor Zinn from the IFO Institute in Munich just wrote an article that the banking system is on the verge of bankruptcy. Bank creditors will not get money back, and that alone, for example, the debt of the six most affected countries in Europe have 9.4 trillion euro outstanding debt, as compared to one-third of that as sovereign debt. Now, if you compare that to the existing instrument, the so-called European Stability Mechanism, which has $80 billion capital and 620 billion guarantees, if you want to serve this debt, you go into a hyperinflation immediately. So there is now a debate about separation of the banks, but we have to make sure that it is the full Glass-Steagall. Now, it is exactly what Richard Fischer was talking about at the National Press Club, namely, you need to have a complete withdrawal of protection for the investment banks, but you have to also get rid of the hedge funds, the private equity funds, shadow banking, and so forth. Now, Glass-Steagall is the hottest issue, but it has to be only the first step. We need immediately with that a credit system in the tradition of the national banking system of Alexander Hamilton. We need to have credit lines for the investment of large infrastructure projects. And the Schiller Institute, for the last, I would say, 40 years, but in particular the last 20 years since the collapse of the, can we go to the slides, of the Iron Wall, we have worked out what actually amounts to a global Marshall Fund, a global program for reconstruction. Now, this is what we published, a report we published immediately in 1990 after the wall in Berlin had fallen and the Iron Curtain was no longer there, which was the idea to integrate the industrial and population centers of Europe and Asia through so-called development corridors. This was at that point only an idea. We had about 100 conferences and presentations, seminars all over the world. Next. And eventually, this developed into the World Land Bridge, which is the idea to connect the whole world from the south of Chile all the way up to Central America, through North America, the Bering Strait Tunnel, the Eurasian Land Bridge, and through a whole bunch of bridges and tunnels into all of Africa. Next. Now, obviously, the connection between North America and Eurasia through the Bering Strait is a project which already is underway. It is the commitment of the Russian government to do that. It has attracted absolute interest from China, from Japan, from Korea, because it is the way to open the Arctic development. Next. Now, one centerpiece of it, obviously, is NAVAPA. NAVAPA would immediately create 6 million jobs. It is the largest water management project ever conceived in the history of mankind. It is exactly in the tradition of the TVA project of Franklin D. Roosevelt. Next. It is supposed to connect also into Latin America through the Pan-American Highway, including the bridging of the Darien Gap, which right now is practically unsurmountable, and a World Wildlife Fund biotope. Next. Here we have, I cannot recognize this. Next. This is the Bering Strait Tunnel more precisely. Next. Now, this is the Arctic development. Now, if we open up the Arctic development for exploration and, you know, even human habitation, this is one of the areas with the largest raw material and resource for the next 100 years of civilization and an absolute crucial project. Next. There are many projects of the Eurasian Land Bridge which now are in different moments of construction. There are large corporations between Chinese and Russian, Koreans. In India, many of the projects which we proposed in the 90s, beginning of the 90s, are now in different phases of completion. Next. In the recent period, we have added an extension of the World Land Bridge into Southern Europe, because the only way how Italy, Greece, Spain, Portugal will ever recover from the present crisis is by having large-scale infrastructure corridors, which were all already drawn in the beginning of the 90s, which are in the drawers of various offices, but they were blocked because of the Troika policy. And this program is supposed to include the development of the Mediterranean. It has a tunnel through the Strait of Gibraltar, a tunnel from Sicily to northern Africa, Tunisia. And next, it is supposed to connect into large infrastructure projects in Africa. Now, this is the Transaqua project. This is the equivalent of of Navapa for Africa. Next. This is another feature where the water of the Congo River is going through 9 countries into the Mediterranean by building a 40-meter wide channel, which will help to irrigate all of the areas which are now complete desert and be a second area of agricultural land besides the Nile. Next. Now, one big problem is that in the last 10,000 years, the deserts of the world have completely expanded. And, for example, if you look at the region of the so-called Middle East, it is entirely desert. If you go from the Atlantic coast of Africa all the way to the Middle East into China, you see this tremendous belt of desert, which absolutely needs to be reversed, and this can be done through next. This is supposed to be infrastructure in this region. Next. This desertification can be accomplished basically through three means. One is the redirecting rivers. This is the Ob and Irtych River, which normally flow into the Arctic in Siberia, which have to be redirected to fill up the Aral Sea, which has been depleted down to 10% of its previous size. Next. Here you see the Aral Sea, which is shrinking and will vanish very soon. And therefore, this redirection of the rivers is a project which is absolutely necessary to undo the damage of the monocultures which existed during the time of the Soviet Union. Next. Then you have a project, the so-called GAP project in Anatolia, which involves altogether 22 dams. A region naturally right now completely contested by ethnic strife between all kinds of tribes, Turkish, Kurdish people. Next. This is the Atatürk Dam next. Now this is the region in the southeastern Anatolia project. It would, if it is completed, create a whole new region of agricultural and other activity. Next. This is the greening of Iraq. This is an absolutely necessary project for this region. Next. This is the desert of essentially the Saudi Arabian Peninsula, which has to be encircled by different greening projects for which we can use in the first phase the water of aquifers, but in the final instance we need large scale of desalinization of ocean water, which only can be accomplished through peaceful nuclear energy, and there we need the inherently safe fourth generation high temperature reactors. Next. This is the beginning of the greening of the desert using these three water sources. Next. And eventually, this will lead to a new vegetation, new rain patterns, new local climate patterns. Next. And eventually, this region will more look like this, with lush gardens, with woods, with vegetable plantations, and so forth. Now, so obviously what we need is this vision, how to transform the globe. Now, the argument obviously of the too big to fail bankers is that in order to do any of these things, you need universal banking, private investment, and so forth. You need free trade, privatization, deregulation. And these bankers say that the biggest danger is that the countries will go back to protectionism and the defense of the national interest. Now, this is the biggest lie ever. It's the argument of the imperial and the colonial systems, because the empires like the Venetians or the British used to control the sea trade, and they followed the principle buy cheap and sell expensive. The equivalent of this are the cheap labor markets of today, where you have child labor, things are being produced for the $1 stores in the United States or in Europe. Now, it comes back to the question, what is the source of wealth in society? It is not raw materials. It is not the control of trade and finance. It is exclusively the creative potential of the domestic population and the increase of the productivity through education in science, technology, and culture. And the more developed the population is, the greater the wealth is of the nation. You need, in addition to that, the sovereign control of credit creation in the tradition of Alexander Hamilton and the First National Bank of America, where the state has the right to create credit for well-defined projects of physical economy in the interest of the common good. It is what Friedrich List, the author of The National Economy and the Customs Union, called the difference between the American and the British system. Now, the economic theory, this economic theory was the basis for the industrialization in Germany, of America, Russia, Japan. It was continued by the ideas of Henry Carey, the economic advisor of Lincoln. And in a few years, Germany became one of the leading industrial nations through the ideas of Henry Carey. Otto von Bismarck, the chancellor who unified Germany, was first a total believer in free trade. And then through the influence of Wilhelm von Kardorff, who was a member of parliament and later became the founder of the Central Association of German Industry for the Development and Protection of National Labor, advised and convinced and recruited Bismarck to turn from a free trader into a believer of protectionism. He basically wrote a book called Against the Stream, where he describes the lies of the free traders and developed the principles of a productive national economy. And I can only advise people that this book is an absolute must read for everybody who wants to study these things today. It is completely omitted out of all official biographies of Bismarck, which is really very amazing. Now, what this theory says is that you have to invest in areas in which you would invest if the economy would be in good shape. And that money creation is not inflationary. And as a matter of fact, it can be proven that every time this was applied, the tax revenues became bigger than the initial credit, simply because of the primary and secondary effect on the economy. Now, the Middle East Development Program, which you can look at the Schiller Conference website in greater detail, naturally can only be realized if the four big powers or the neighbor powers agree to make peace in this region, namely Russia, China, India, and Iran, and hopefully the United States, Germany, France, Italy, Japan, and others, agree that you have to have a perspective of having peaceful development and have a vision which is an incentive for this region to agree on a higher level of reason, something which is, you know, to the advantage of all parties and is a vision for the youth. We have to draw a picture. How should the world look in 50 years from now? Should the Middle East, and when I mean Middle East, I mean the region from Central Asia to Afghanistan, Pakistan, all the way to the Gulf states and the Mediterranean, should this region have in 50 years or maybe earlier an infrastructure as dense as Europe today? And what I mean by that, if you ever have been traveling along the Rhine, you see the cargo ships which then go in computerized train stations and go to production centers without any interruption. And that is exactly what we need to have in the Middle East. We have to have a vision of beautiful cities in places where you have desert today. And these beautiful cities should have the architecture of the ancient Silk Road, of the Caliphate Abbasid periods, and not look like Houston. We have to have the idea of lush woods, vegetable gardens, green landscapes where basically deserts and sandstorms are dominating today. We need a renaissance of the period when Baghdad was the leading capital of the world, when Harun al-Rashid and al-Mansur paid in gold every discovery which was brought to them from Mediterranean countries, and when scholars like al-Kindi, al-Farabi, Ibn Sina were continuing the heritage of the Platonic tradition in that part of the world. Now, and we will hear more from that from the second next speaker, is it realistic to think that way in front of the present situation when the Middle East is a powder keg which could lead to World War III? Now, if you look at the trail of destruction of the regime change policy of the British and the US government starting basically with the fall of the Soviet Union. You look at Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Syria, Libya, the Gaza Strip. You look at the destruction of the wars, the bombed out houses. You have now a conflict between Shiites and Sunni, which easily could develop into a 100-year war. If you look at the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is that a realistic perspective? Does Henry Kissinger have right when he says that the peace of Westphalia principle is not valid for this region? Well, I strongly say no. I think the Peace of Westphalia is the only way how peace in that region can occur. And, well, how did the Peace of Westphalia come into being? It was the conclusion of 150 years religious war, topped by the 30 Years' War, which had left large parts of Europe totally destroyed, 80%, so that the people finally got to the table to recognize that if they would not now stop this, there would be nobody left to enjoy the result. Now, the Peace of Westphalia developed very important principles. The first principle being, for the peace, for the sake of peace, let's stop all vengeance, let's forget all the crimes from the one or the other party and put it behind us. The principle number two being, for the sake of peace, let's make love the basis of foreign policy. Let's make the interest of the other our own interest. And thirdly, Cameralism developed, namely the role of the state in the reconstruction after the war. Now, is that realistic? Well, if the people in the Peace of Westphalia could recognize that they would not live if they would continue, maybe in light of the fact that everybody who knows anything about the region, that a strike against Iran leads to the thermonuclear destruction of civilization, is that not an incentive enough? If you look, for example, at the long history of bitter hostilities between Germany and France, who used to be arch enemies, where in the war of 1870, large territorial disputes remained a scorn in the flesh of people. In the First World War, there were 4 years of fighting between German and French troops, senseless fighting and killing, 4 years in the trenches, sometimes only a few meters ahead, a few meters back, and 4 years of complete destruction and derouting of entire generations. In 1923, the French occupation of the Rhineland, because Germany did not pay the expected amount according to the Versailles Treaty, triggered the hyperinflation of 1923, and that also escalated the hatred against the French. On top of the humiliation of the Versailles Treaty, now you had the complete expropriation of the people. Then World War III, again, bitter fights. Out of this, Adenauer and de Gaulle made the foundation of a new German-French friendship. And we have just now the 50-year anniversary of the Élysée Treaty, and, you know, people are studying the other language, the youth exchanges. And while they are far from being what we would make out of it if we were the governments, nevertheless, you know, there is an example that you can overcome such conflicts. How did they do it? Adenauer and de Gaulle went back to the roots of both countries in Charlemagne, and they came up with a common vision for Europe of the fatherlands. Now, you cannot come to this if you remain in the thinking of Aristotelian contradictions. If you make a long list of ethnic religious conflicts, but you have to have a completely different thinking, namely thinking on the method of the coincidentia oppositorum, the coincidence of opposites. The method developed by Nicolaus of Cusa, that the one has a higher priority and a higher power than the many. You have to think the way Nicolaus of Cusa developed it in the famous dialogue De Pace Fide about peace in religion, which he wrote after the fall of Constantinople in 1453, which was a clash of civilization of its time, where many people were killed. And he said the 17 nations and religions went to God, and they said to God, "We each pretend that we are in the sole possession of truth, but we all kill each other in your name. That cannot be your interest." And then God answered, "Well, you are all philosophers in your religions, and therefore you can recognize that there is only one truth." And they said, yes, that we can understand, but still, we have killed each other so many times. Can you help us some more? And then God said, well, you make the, as philosophers, you recognize there is only one truth, but you make the mistake to mistake the words of the prophets for the one truth. And they say, yes, but help us more. And then God said, you make the mistake also that you mistake the one truth with the many traditions. And then God said, yes, but the religion, the representative said, but what should we do? How should we talk to our people? And then God said, well, go out, go back to your people and teach them that there is only one truth, that there is only one God, and that there is only one religion which is above all the religions of the prophets. And that is what, you know, the solution obviously must be. Now, the truth Nicolaus talks about is not some static body of facts which man can learn about through sensuous experience, but it is a process of continuous creation which man participates in when he acts on his creative potential, discovering more and more principles about the physical universe and natural science and classical art. And in doing so, it is not that every generation has to start from scratch. Even so, the moral obligation for each individual to do that remains the same and new. But I believe that Vladimir Vernadsky was absolutely right when he said that the noosphere would gradually have a greater and greater role over the biosphere. Now, therefore, the identity of human beings, different from all other living beings, is that he is not a creature of sensuous experience, but it is his identity to discover these principles. It is what Friedrich Schiller wrote in The Force of the Aesthetical Letters. Each individual human being carries, one can say, according to his constitution and destination, a pure ideal human being within him. And to coincide with that unchangeable unity in all of its development and changes is the great task of his existence. Now, how to get to this coincidence with one's own ideal personality? How to make that inner truth that corresponds to that great task of our existence the guiding principle of our action? As compared to sensuous gratification of pleasure in the here and now, which is what most people are dominated by. It is through the aesthetical education of man, through classical composition in music, classical drama, poetry, and similar forms of art. Why is this the means to get that transformation? Well, you start in music, in classical music, or in a poem with a musical or poetical idea. You have the development of that idea, what you call in music thorough composition, like a polyphonic contrapuntal fugue of Johann Sebastian Bach. And then you arrive at a higher level of truth. In the classical drama, you start with the pregnant moment, which is like a seed containing all potentialities, which later unfold like a tiny seed already contains the entire potential of a full-grown oak. Then, through the development, you arrive at the punctum saliens, which is the point of decision with the highest degree of freedom. And depending on the motive of the principal figure in the drama, it will be decided if there is a positive resolution of the conflict or it ends up as a tragedy. If the drama is in the classical form, its inner lines of actions follow the same principle like the polyphonic contrapuntal fugue. And it is the same with a classical poem. You start with the poetical idea in the form of a metaphor, a paradox, or an irony. And then through a process of densification, and the German word is actually Verdichtung, densification, one arrives at a higher level of meaning which could not be expressed in simple prose. Now, looking at the world today, we have to ask the same question Schiller asked. How comes that we are still barbarians? And we have to come, or I come to the same conclusion like him, that the education of the Empfindungsvermögen, of empathy, of sensitive compassion, of emotional resonance with the condition of humanity is the answer. You must not only educate the power of imagination, you have and have a vision of what the future has to be, but you have to have the power of compassion, of love for mankind. But man is not only man on the planet Earth. Our planet is situated in an expanding, evolving universe. Cosmic processes affect us, which we have to master. Next month, there comes an asteroid flying by our Earth in a relatively short distance, and we should take that as a wake-up call, that this mankind presently does not have the ability to deflect or protect itself against large objects hitting on the Earth. The last major such event was in 1908 in Siberia, Tunguska, where a relatively small object of only 30 to 50 meters across hit, but it already affected a crater larger than the region of New York, the larger area around it. A more severe impact was that of 65 million years ago, which had about 10 kilometers across, and that created a crater of 180 kilometers in the Yucatan Peninsula in Mexico and led to the great extinction and, in all likelihood, the extinction of the dinosaurs. Now, that had an energy release of 100 million megatons, and this was about 20,000 times the estimate of what the destructive power of the entire nuclear arsenal of the world is. And it led to a large period of the equivalent of a nuclear winter blocking the sun for years. Now, obviously, such large events occur fairly seldom, but smaller objects could hit the Earth very easily and lead to the extinction. Now, if you look at all of these threats, also other ones, extreme weather, which we are in New York, you have seen very recently, the outbreak of volcanoes, tsunamis, earthquakes, the drug plague, which is leading to menticide of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. Don't you think we should have a movement for the common aims of mankind, trying to conquer all of these dangers through the means of our creative potential? Obviously, this requires a leap in knowledge about the cosmic effects on the planet. We need to go to higher flux density energies, technologies based on those. And we need to move consciously into a new era of mankind, which must be guided by what Kraft-Ehrke called the extraterrestrial imperative, as the conscious next phase of the evolution of mankind. This must be guided by the power of reason and the wisdom of the moral law within ourselves, as Kraft-Ehrke put it. That means we have to comprehend and to colonize nearby space as a first step. And this is not just an option, but the necessary next step. But it has to be connected with the aesthetical education of man. Because if we don't become more human, if we don't become more what is worth of the dignity of man, all of this will not function. And Kraft-Ehrke, who was a close friend of us in the last years of his life, said, you know, the absolute importance of the ideas of Friedrich Schiller, the aesthetical education, the turning of people into real loving human beings capable of agape for the rest of mankind has to go along with these technological developments. Now, when the ISS crew came back from their last mission, they made a press conference and they said that the dinosaurs made the mistake not to place their DNS on other planets. Now, we must think of mankind as the only potentially immortal species. Now we have to think ahead, because the sun in latest 3 billion years, it's not tomorrow, but it's coming, is no longer making the Earth a livable place. Now, most geophysicists, when you ask them, they dismiss that and say, oh, yeah, man only appeared 1 minute before 12, and it will disappear 1 minute after 12. Now, I think this is not acceptable, because if you look at this in perspective, mankind is only around a meager 7 million years. Recorded written history is only available since about 3,500 years. That's only a couple, I think 200 generations. That's not very much. Now, if you would have told a Stone Age man about the internet, about viruses, fusion power, or the activities of curiosity of man, what would this Stone Age man have said? Now, just think, how will mankind look 1,000 years from now? I'm very optimistic that if we are still around, people will have forgotten about Jamie Dimon, but they will think about Kraft-Ericke.